it's time for your weekly dose of technology news, podcast direct to you from The Guardian. Yes, it's Tuesday. It must be time for Tech Weekly. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week I've laid my eye patch and my pieces of eight down in solidarity with Peter Sunday of Pirate Bay, the convicted file sharing site.
I made a payment to it. I have this IOU, 31 million Swedish. Just kidding.
No. I think that's as close as they're going to get to any money from us.
Not, of course, that I would share files myself. It just seems that solidarity is the thing to do. Joining me in walking the plank on this week's show is a full house of the best and the brightest in technology journalism. Ms. Jemima, Captain Jack Sparrow Kish.
All right, me arties.
Bobby Blackbeard Johnson.
You know, I cut myself shaving today for the first time in years. I think I don't get to be called Blackbeard.
Well, work. You can be called, I don't know.
Redbeard.
Redbeard.
Yeah. Nice.
And Charles the Kraken, Arthur.
Yarr.
Welcome to you all. Thank you very much for putting up with my little amusements. Charles, what have you been doing this week?
Actually, I've been doing nothing at all. I haven't laid hands on a computer because I had a holiday with my family and we went completely, you know, no computers, no nothing.
Jemima, could you do that?
No. I've been playing with dongles. I was on the M4 and I wanted to see if I could use a dongle to watch iPlayer on a netbook, which actually surprisingly worked within London, and then of course as soon as you lost signal it was just hell.
That's great. 5 years ago, if you said I was on the M4 and I wanted to see if I could watch iPlayer on a dongle on a netbook, people would have looked at you and known that you were totally certifiable. Now it's a sentence that makes sense.
Bobby, are you certified this week?
I've just started going crazy because about 5 minutes before we started recording my broadband went down and I'm certifiably violent towards Comcast right now.
And you're quite far away, which is good. But as well as sailing the seven seas in search of the implications for the Pirate Bay findings, we're also looking at the numbers in Oracle's recent $7.4 billion deal with Sun Microsystems and the reality behind the sudden interest in electric cars. The experts weigh in. We've also got more of the latest news, plus feedback from our blogs. There really is quite an astonishing amount to get in this week. And before we get started, we'd like to make a special request that you all go to the Webby Awards nomination pages and vote for The Guardian in all six of the categories it's up for, including the podcasts.
Hey.
That's the only plug in the pod, I promise, or I'll be swimming with the fishes. Right, okay, I'm sorry, it's enough. Keep listening for 30 or so minutes of technology here on The Guardian. It was just a fortnight ago when we reported that a deal between IBM and Sun Microsystems was on the cards. Well, that plan fell through, but it seems that Charles's New Year's predictions about the credit crunch have actually come to pass.
By the time we get to May of 09, it's going to be into its third year. Things are getting harder and harder. And I think Sun Microsystems is going to, I'm afraid, go down. The economics of it are just a bit tight.
Ooh, prescient. Well, indeed, US technology giant Oracle paid $9.50 per share earlier this week, integrating the struggling software and hardware company into its mighty library of properties. We're joined by Phil Dawson, VP of Research at Gartner, who'll guide us through the acquisition. Phil, thank you very much for coming on the show, and no, I'm sorry, I don't have a pirate name for you.
Well, it's nice to be here, and it's good to be lighthearted after such a heavy day, to be honest with you.
Well, then answer me this, Phil. As a business solutions provider, Oracle, they seem to have landed quite a big fish. We are really continuing with these pirate seafaring themes today. No, don't worry. Again, that's it. Now, obviously, Sun developed Java, and they bought the open source database MySQL in 2008. So how does this acquisition changed the landscape of the technology scene at the minute?
Well, I think it's an interesting consolidation of two very key players that, you know, 10 years ago, Oracle and Sun and other vendors like BEA and Veritas made each other great by selling on the .com. But now, Oracle's just about taking them all out. And I think it's interesting. Oracle is the vendor that's trying to redefine the system space with this move. And when you speak to Larry about it, all he wants to do is have Java and have Solaris. I was a bit sort of wondering what's happened to the hardware. They didn't mention the hardware much at all. And I think the Sun guys are really wanting to look at, you know, what is the future of their hardware, both the Spark, the x86 business, etc. And that's the bit I'm unsure about yet. We'll have to think about that a little longer, I think.
Bobby, how is the news being viewed on the other side of the Atlantic?
I think it's still a bit of a surprise, to be honest. Lots of people are taken aback. I mean, you know, we know that Oracle, buccaneers, and we'll jump in wherever they can and squeeze some value out of stuff. I think really, it's a bit of a kick in the balls, to be honest, for the whole kind of dot-com boom, certainly the dot-com industry. I mean, that's what Sun's built its business on. And everyone here, you know, they're doing the same as we are. They're scratching their heads, wondering whether Oracle is going to make them pay for things that they don't have to pay for at the moment.
Do you think that Larry Ellison, at the head of Oracle, jumped in really quick when he saw that the IBM and Sun talks were falling apart? Or is this something that they've been swimming around each other for a while?
It's no surprise that Sun had been acquired. I think everybody was caught out a little bit with the timing that it was Oracle. And I think what Oracle has done that IBM would have done is very different. You know, IBM's, it would have been a highly duplex strategy that they had to make some very severe choices. And I think there's more synergy between the Sun portfolio and the Oracle portfolio, but there's still a lot of questions to ask that we need to ask as well.
So the question that I would be asking is, I mean, you know, what use is Solaris, for example, to Oracle? What use is MySQL, which is very widely used, but generally only used for free database? You know, it's essential to all the Web 2.0 companies.
But I think those two things have to be addressed separately. There are some common themes. You've got the open Solaris efforts, of course, which if Sun had declared Solaris as open source before Linux, then Linux might not have had the flurry that it's had in the enterprises we see. They did react late to that, and even Oracle has got on board of Linux before and more ahead of what we've seen with Sun.
But Larry Ellison is never a guy to give something away if he can get some money for it instead.
Larry definitely said it's more about giving more to customers who pay the same money. He didn't say about paying less.
But he's never. It's easy to say these things, but the actions speak louder, don't they? And
yeah.
Oracle is one could say notorious as a company that is very much looking for getting a bit more money out of people. I mean, surely the real question now is whether there's going to be a program of disposition of all the bits of Sun that just don't fit with Oracle, or whether Oracle is going to try to fit them together, isn't it? I mean, what route do you see Oracle taking?
Oracle is a successful software company. I'm not trying to compliment them too much. Sun tried to be a software company, but could only make money out of hardware with it. And I think that's where the difference lies.
Does that mean the death of the Spark servers and things like that, then?
Not necessarily the death, but I think that on the back of the recent Fujitsu move, obviously the buyout of Fujitsu Siemens, that's going to make things very interesting with some of the relationships they've got there. It's going to redefine or at least question it.
But I mean, Oracle won't have much interest in trying to hawk around Spark servers
fully
and stuff,
agree.
Will it?
Fully agree.
So, where do they go? Do they make them if people are prepared to pay enough? Because they won't, will they?
Actually, Sun will be diverged into these completely different divisions, and maybe Oracle will ditch the hardware parts and sell them off to, maybe to IBM. Maybe everyone comes out of this a winner. IBM buys up the hardware part of Sun from Oracle, and suddenly everyone's got what they wanted, apart from Sun, really, which ends up being subsumed by everybody else.
I don't think IBM needs Spark at all, though.
Well, that's pretty sorry. If you got a Spark server and you'd like to know what your future is, so would we.
I think Oracle could do a Cisco. I think they could start looking at x86 appliances, x86 frames, new forms of form factor for the data centers, cloud fabrics. I know it's all buzzwords, but I really think they could look at big appliances, little appliances, and really look at ways of positioning IT infrastructure differently. But Oracle's definition of a system is to Solaris. It is not to the processor. There are some other things I think that I'm a little still unclear in my mind. I don't know what the future of Star Office will be. For example, some German journalist asked me that this afternoon, and he got me on that one, I'll be honest with you.
What about the future for Scott McNeely and Jonathan Schwartz? Do you think they're going to have perhaps a couple of months at Oracle and then suddenly find their desks in the lift?
To be honest with you, I think what we're going to see is Scott will do his role, do the transition. That would be an important play. I wouldn't be surprised if Jonathan hung around and became head of a division of Oracle, because I think, you know, he probably is going to look for some form of continuity. I think Jonathan probably feels he's still got work to do.
And finally, a big miss by IBM or a disaster narrowly avoided by IBM?
2 weeks ago, IBM could have controlled two-thirds of the Unix market. Now they're back to a third. I think it's a big miss.
Well, thank you very much, Phil. That was Phil Dawson from Gartner. And you can read up on the latest acquisition analysis and news on guardian.co.uk/technology. And of course, yes, if you are a Spark Server user, do get in touch. We'd love to hear what you think. Now here's the latest news from Jemima.
Google has been accused of tax avoidance after an investigation claimed 90% of the firm's £1.25 billion UK revenues are channeled through Ireland. Corporation tax in the Republic is 12.5% compared to 28% in the UK, but the government has pledged to cut down on tax evasion in this week's budget. The four men behind torrent tracking site Pirate Bay were found guilty of assisting copyright infringement by a Swedish court last Friday at the conclusion of a two-month trial. The four face a year in jail and fines of nearly $1 million each, but have said they will refuse to pay the penalty and pledge to appeal. President Obama has confirmed Anish Chopra as the first Chief Technology Officer of the US, much to the delight of Silicon Valley. Currently Technology Secretary for Virginia, Chopra will have to overhaul the government's IT plans, but has built respect in the industry for his innovative approach. Search engine Ask.com has resurrected Jeeves, its butler icon, for UK users. Ask explained his 3-year absence by saying he'd been on holiday and has returned to Blighty armed with answers, though he might also need a good deal of luck to take on Google's 80% share of the search market.
Thanks, Jemima. The biggest story this week, winning the most column inches and airtime award, is certainly the result of the Pirate Bay trial. The four founders have been handed hefty fines from the Swedish government and face prison time for providing a search engine that identifies torrents for file sharers. To discuss the implications is Joe Oliver, general counsel for the IFPI. Joe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell me, what is the top line? What are the results from your point of view?
Well, for us, this is really good news for artists and others in the creative industries because it confirms that they are entitled to be paid for their work.
But isn't the real problem that these sorts of findings never lead to any reduction in file sharing? Napster was, the original incarnation of Napster was shut down, didn't lead to a decrease. Kazaa and Groxa had findings against them, didn't lead to a decrease. Pirate Bay gets a fine handed down, hasn't led to a decrease.
I would probably take issue with your view that it hasn't led to a decrease at all. We think it certainly moved things forward and has changed the landscape significantly. And I guess part of the answer now is the legitimate services that are available to consumers that perhaps have developed exponentially, I would say, since the time of Napster. The industry has been really working to respond to consumer demand, which we perhaps didn't do so well back in the time of Napster, and to really give people what they want, but to have a model that also ensures compensation for artists and for the creative industries.
There's a danger here, though, that what has happened through this case is that it's been polarized into a very kind of simple technology versus, you know, big corporations argument. And that's perhaps a little... It doesn't really do much justice to the finer points of this discussion, which is that the technology here should not be on trial. I mean, there's a technology here that is used by a huge number of people and is effective and very popular and comprehensive, and that, you know, perhaps the music industry could have done and should be doing more to engage with technology that people like, that works, rather than being seen to attack it, just to play devil's avocado for a minute.
I think we certainly agree with you that technology is not on trial. in connection with this case. This case was really about criminal enterprise. So these four individuals were found guilty of aiding and abetting copyright infringement. It was found to be deliberate action. They had an agreement between them to share the proceeds of what they were doing. They had corporations set up in the BVI to avoid paying tax. This is certainly a deliberate criminal operation. So we're by no means against the technology, and while I think everyone would accept that perhaps back in the time of Napster, it was more difficult for consumers to get what they wanted online. There are a lot of options available now, and it's not perfect. The market is developing. Things are new. Record companies are trying out different options. There's free streaming services, for example. There's paid for download services. These are all different models that we're trying out, and we hope that consumers will enjoy them.
Do you think maybe that if there are any services in the future, though, that are based on file sharing or torrents, and that if the music industry wants to back a service that is legitimate, they might have shot themselves in the foot a bit?
No, I disagree. I think with any legitimate service, there has to be enforcement against those who don't take a license. That's the nature of enforcement. And the two things have to travel in parallel. The legitimate services can't really exist unless they are given breathing space by cutting out those who don't comply with the law.
Joe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And also in big news was the announcement of U.S. President Obama's technology czar, Anish Chopra. And as our man in the mean streets of the States, what's the sense on this newcomer, Bobby?
We've been following this one for months, really, since Obama said, you know, he was going to bring in someone who's going to be really the kind of boss of technology across the whole of the U.S. Names that have been thrown into the mix along the way are kind of Silicon Valley statesmen like Eric Schmidt, like Vint Cerf. And instead, we've got Anish Chopra, who is currently the Secretary of Technology in the state of Virginia. He's got his fans and his backers, but I think what's really happened here is that a job that people thought was going to be this kind of real visionary overseer of the industry and really kind of bring America into the 21st century, actually it turns out that this is looks more or less like a kind of way of making government work better through technology, which is, you know, very laudable, getting schools to use open source and, you know, kind of saving money in lots of places. But it's not really the kind of the massive job that Silicon Valley wanted. And it's not even a cabinet level position, which is what had been first touted. You know, they like Chopra, but they're disappointed here about the scope of the job.
Well, we definitely look forward to following his progress and what the Obama administration does intend to do with engagement via technology. And you can read up on all these stories and the latest headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. For a £5,000 sweetener, would you buy an electric car?
What we've got to get people used to is the idea that electric cars will become quite normal, quite usual, that people will have one, it won't be exceptional. And frankly, without being unkind to existing electric vehicles, they won't be slightly odd. They will be cars that conform to appropriate safety standards and people use on an everyday basis.
That was Secretary of State for Transport Jeff Hoon announcing Labour's plans to push the electric car revolution forward as part of a £250 million strategy to transform Britain's roads into a low-carbon network. The scheme will help to create an infrastructure for the vehicles, including power points and subsidies for trades. Thanks to the congestion charge scheme in London, you can already see the charge-exempt vehicles silently zipping through the capital streets. But are they better than the other green options? Robert Evans of Senex is on the line to talk us through. Robert, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, can you tell me what the different types of green vehicles that are already available, that are already on the road are?
On UK roads, we've got an increasing number of battery electric cars, most particularly in London. We've also had alternative fuel vehicles, for example, that run on bioethanol or liquid petroleum gas. But essentially, petrol and diesel has dominated.
We've been led to believe through the schemes, the strategies, and obviously the announcements that happened last week that electric are better than the rest. Is that true?
battery electric is very much about the future. We've got a target for the UK of an 80% reduction in carbon by 2050. And in order to achieve that 80% reduction, that can't be done with vehicles running on petrol and diesel. You've got to go to electric vehicles, whether they're powered by green electricity from the grid or whether they're running on hydrogen and fuel cells.
But isn't one of the problems with, even if you shift to electricity, you either have regenerative systems where when you would be braking, you're putting that energy into the battery, or else you're charging it off the grid, as you say. But the amount of green electricity that's being generated is nowhere near enough that if you're charging your car from off the electric grid, the reality is that 80% of it at the moment is going to be generated with carbon-generating systems, and there's no feasible carbon capture system for coal or gas-fired plants at the moment at all?
I think first of all to say, even with the grid at mix as it is, if you're running an electric vehicle, you're still running on lower carbon emissions than you would be if you're running on a petrol or diesel. And really, when you look at the electricity generating side, you see very many more options for decarbonising electricity supply. Already we have hydro in the UK, hydroelectric plants, but we've got wind turbines, wave power, solar power. Then there's the later option of nuclear. And in addition to that, carbon capture and storage on coal and gas-fired plants. And the electric vehicles will undoubtedly leverage that.
But one of the criticisms is unfortunately that the sort of generation of new plants that are going to be coping with the number of electric cars that are on the roads is actually going to counteract the benefits. Are those not going to have a greater impact on the UK environment when it comes to actually rolling out the number of electric cars that are being proposed?
I think, first of all, just taking a step back, of course, there is a big benefit of electric vehicles in terms of they're having zero pollutant emissions at point of source. So as the vehicles are driving around our streets, they're not emitting any airborne pollutants. There's no NOx or particulate and other things that are causing health effects, and no carcinogens are being put out into the environment. So the pollutants that are being emitted is being moved back, as you say, to the power station. And there we're talking mostly about carbon, but obviously some, a far lesser burden in terms of associated pollutant emissions. So, when you're walking around the streets of a city, there's going to be huge benefits in terms of lower pollutant emissions and noise from electric vehicles. On the issue of where the charging of those vehicles and the impact on the grid, I think one of the important things that's coming out and people are understanding is the time of day when the vehicle charges. Because at the moment we have a very high demand for electricity at particular peak times, such as between 6 and 9 o'clock in the evening and early in work time, from say, sort of as people arrive into work and all switch on their computers. If electric vehicles are being charged at that same point, those times of peak demand, then they are going to be having a big burden on the grid, and they will be potentially being powered by the less environmentally friendly means of power generation. Whereas if they can be charged at night time, there's a lot of capacity there to be used, including the renewables that at the moment, the wind still blows in the middle of the night.
I was lucky enough to be given a lift in a Honda Insight the other day, which is kind of the new generation of Prius, which is electric and petrol mix, I believe. But it has really nice features in it, like on the dashboard, when you're driving along at a sort of fuel economic speed, it glows green. And then as soon as you put your foot down or something, it changes to blue, which is a really nice feature. So they're making it obviously more kind of environmentally aware. But one side issue that Radio 4's In Touch programme explored recently was the issue of sound. The fact that these cars often make very little or no noise is actually quite an important safety issue. I wondered what your thoughts were on how designers are kind of tackling that and how they're making them safer.
Cars themselves have been getting quieter and quieter. Undoubtedly, electric vehicles are very quiet, and that's one of the great advantages when you're driving them. You really feel this sort of silence around you. It's a very pleasant driving experience. But those of us who drive electric vehicles do are very conscious of the fact that if you're pulling up to junctions that maybe people are expecting to hear an engine running, so they don't know if you're going to move. Likewise, you don't know if they're going to move. And the vehicle manufacturers are aware of that. And one of the things that they're looking at, one of the technologies, is a sort of noise projection where you only hear the noise if you pass in front of them or if an obstacle is near the vehicle.
I was just wondering, we've heard about this £250 million and £5,000 kind of teaser to go and buy an electric car. But how much of this is going into infrastructure? I mean, over here in California, we've seen local governments putting $1 billion into creating a kind of network of charging points. But how much of the UK money is going into it? Because obviously, there's no point buying an electric car if you can't charge it up when you're, you know, in a car park or on the street, is there?
And some of the $250 million has been earmarked for infrastructure investments, because it's definitely recognised that you're more likely to buy an electric vehicle if there's on-street car parking with charging points, or when you went to your local supermarket, there were charging points, even though probably with the mileage that you're driving, you're unlikely to need to charge up. It's just it's a peace of mind issue. But the majority of charging is likely to take place at people's homes. People are likely to, you know, in their off-street parking, or if they're a garage user, are just likely to use a three-pin plug.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Robert. That was Robert Evans from Cenex. And for more on this and other news on the electric car revolution, head to www.guardian.co.uk/environment/electric-cars.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and in the latest Science Weekly, a brain special, sort of.
You know, the trick for monogamy is to figure out ways to stimulate yourself so that once you're in relationships, you can maintain that sense of novelty with the beloved. You're going to have to figure out ways of doing it without getting multiple partners, if that's your goal in monogamy.
Psychiatrist Norman Doidge tells us why it's never too late for your brain to be molded. And we have a word with Baroness Susan Greenfield, neuroscientist at Oxford University.
Is the best we can do, is this the crown of creation, to sit in a room alone playing a computer game?
All that plus some non-brain stuff too. GM crops in Germany, building machines from parts of living organisms, and how NASA plans to name a new room in its space station. That's all on Science Weekly from The Guardian at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
If you've been listening to Science Weekly, Alok mentioned that we'd have an interview with Baroness Greenfield. Jemima tackled her about the reported detrimental comments that she made about social networking sites and gaming, that they're physiologically harmful. Well, we've bumped that interview to next week's show, so listen up then. Now, in the meantime, here's what you've been saying on the blogs. Bobby.
I like to comment. I wrote something about the Ask Jeeves, the return of Jeeves. And I was saying that the way that Jeeves's voice was written, you know, telling you why he was back, reminded me a bit of Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins, because it was full of jolly hockey sticks and all of that kind of stuff. And Slabman left a comment saying, I'm no Woodhouseian, but while blighty and jolly might have been in Bertie Wooster's vocabulary, Jeeves would have only used those words in irony. So not only have they got muddled branding, but they've poorly executed it too. I think, you know, it just seems a bit patronising, doesn't it?
Well, over on the games blog, Greg's been asking if mobile phone games have been playing it safe with the releases of games like Tetris or classic re-releases of things like Crash Bandicoot. We've had quite a bit of debate on that, and you can imagine that the people who are very passionate about this world are getting very passionate. But I think the most succinct and the most interesting game design idea came from Killer B, and he says, what the iPhone Touch what the iPhone and the iPod Touch really need is some clever software that can turn the songs on your phone or your iPod into an Elite Beat Agent-style rhythm action game. He says that would be the killer app for me. Charles, you look very confused.
I was just wondering if that isn't just Tap Tap Revenge, actually. Isn't that the game?
I shall suggest it quickly, forthwith upon the blog. What have you been reading about on tech?
I had exactly the same one as Bobby.
It was my post. I'm the winner.
And I'll quickly go over to Jemima.
Yeah.
Sorry, Charles. If I had a spare... Well, I've got lots of spare ones, but anyway. Pirate Bay. I did a post asking about sort of the impact on innovation of that decision, and, you know, perhaps music industries should look like they're supporting new stuff a bit more. Just asking the question. Iceman77 said, innovation? What was innovative about Pirate Bay? It was just a bunch of links to pirated media. And as for Jeff Taylor's comment, support the future of British music by downloading legally. Why? They excrete pile after pile of polished turds and ensures that all our ears are filled by the dirge night and day. Oh, you get the idea. But he was that was so funny. I like that one.
I just love it when Doc Cotton comes and comments on the book.
You can see the
she's cool music these
she's
days.
She's 82. June Brown.
Yeah.
She's 82.
And I mean, held together with technology.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, she's still alive with technology. You can see all the photos from that performance. Beautiful, Jemima, over on our Flickr site. But
it's the baby. It's the baby. It's the hormones.
It's the pregnancy hormones that are going straight to your brain. Meanwhile, back on the Twitterverse, Patty MCC is disappointed that last week's show was only 16 minutes when I promised 30 minutes at the start. And Facebook user Gavin Driver also complained of the exact same thing. I didn't realize that we were being observed quite so closely. Get your stopwatches at the ready. Well, as Bobby says, and Bobby, you can say this because I might get, I don't know, firebombed or something.
Thanks very much. So you're throwing me out. Well, no, I blame the Christians.
Nothing but political correctness here. Yes, there are no problems with doing a short program this week. Anyway, it was a bank holiday, so I apologize.
It was a double bank holiday.
It was a double bank holiday, so I apologize that hopefully this will definitely be closer to the, I don't know, the 50-minute mark.
Actually, let's blame the banks. Hey, you know, if we blame the banks...
I think we've made up the difference, haven't we?
Absolutely. Well, meanwhile, Simon Thurston, also on our Facebook group, would like a visual rendition of my sorry face, as he says, at the Genius Bar in San Francisco when I discovered that my hard drive was on its way out.
Which reminds me, I need to put up that video of you doing country dancing at the Broken Spoke in Austin.
Go on, add it to our Flickr group. You can find all the links, thank you very much, Jemima, at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Oh, and do vote for us at the Webby Awards. Oops, I said it again.
In this week's tech section from The Guardian, more on Oracle buying Sun. We analyse why the database company would buy a hardware and a software company and ask, what next? Is CompuServe still going? It was one of the very original ways onto the internet and it's closing completely in June. Is it a footnote for history? Free Our Data looks at what's happening to Auden Survey. It looks likely that it'll be pushed into the commercial spotlight, but the government won't yet actually implement free data. And we ask whether robots that will cut the grass are becoming a reality. We review the Squeezebox boom and look at the e-book wars, just like VHS and Betamax in the past. It's all in this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much to our guests, Joe Oliver, Robert Evans, and Phil Dawson. Thanks as well to our lovely full house of regulars, Bobby, Charles, and Jemima. And three cheers to our producer Scott.
Woohoo!
Yes, indeed. And don't you dare cut that up and out, Scott. Come back next Tuesday for more of the same, only slightly different. I predict that gaming is on the cards. I'm Alex Kratowski, also known as Mystic Alex, and thank you very much for listening.